Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable on this Tuesday. It's St. Patrick's Day, and we're very excited for it to be St. Patrick's Day. And we're listening to the music of Cherish the Laddies, and they're going to be playing the Town Crier in Beacon on Friday. That's the 20th, and you can find out more information at towncrier.com. Town with an E, towncrier.com. And Cherish the Laddies will be providing our bumper music throughout this St. Patrick's Day morning. And we welcome you for all of those, for those of you who celebrate, happy St. Patrick's Day. And for those of you who are just holding out for 2 days for the Feast of St. Joseph, which I hope you do, that's in 2 days.
2 days.
Yes, that's the 19th. So keep that in mind. So while you're getting the corned beef ready, we have a show to do, and we have a lot to talk about, and we will do that in just a moment. Two things I want to mention. I mentioned this during the billboard, but we're going to have a very special interview coming up at 11 o'clock. Melissa Oftemauer is an amazing musician, photographer, and runs Basilica Hudson in Hudson, and she is, I'm sorry, is it ladies? It's ladies and not laddies. I apologize. It's ladies.
I wondered, because I thought it was ladies.
Yeah.
Cherish the Ladies.
I will say that this is the 13th reminder I've had in the last 12 days I need new glasses. Okay. So, yes, cherish the ladies. And I apologize to all parties involved. Anyway, Melissa Oftemauer was the bassist for the band Hole with Courtney Love. She was with the Smashing Pumpkins. She was a center of the iconic bands of the 1990s and the grunge scene. And she has written a stunning new memoir called Even the Good Girls Will Cry, a 90s rock memoir. Her birthday is today, March 17th. You also have a birthday in your family.
Yeah, my son Miles is 11 today. Our whole family has calendar holiday birthdays. I'm New Year's Day, so the calendar starts with me.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, I became a mother on Mother's Day, though that holiday does float around, so it's not always his birthday. And then my son Miles was born with pointy ears of a leprechaun on St. Patrick's Day, enough so that we actually asked a doctor if we needed to get them corrected, and they were like, no, it'll be fine. They'll round out with time, and they have. So
no, Spock's just fine, Anna.
Yeah. It worked for Obama. It'll work for my son.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a very good point. So Melissa will be with us at 11 o'clock for the full hour, and we'll talk to her. And it's a really fascinating conversation about her life as a musician in the 90s. And it really, for not only just Women's History Month, but also just to hear what she has done in the field of music, was able to do in the field of music during that time, which was, rife with drugs and suicide and just a horrible circumstances that she was able to avoid. And so we'll talk to her coming up at 11 o'clock this morning. On Friday's show, we are going to welcome winner of the National Book Award, Ibram X. Kendi, will be with us. He is of course, well-known best-selling author and professor, and he has written a new book. It's out also today, called Chain of Ideas, The Origins of Our Authoritarian Age. And in this, he looks at the Great Replacement Theory, about how it's moved from the margins to become the most dominant political theory of our time, and posits what we can do to safeguard democracy from the threat of that. And we've had Dr. Kendi on many times before. He is a friend of our program. We're very excited to have him back. He'll be with us for the full hour on Friday morning. So that's coming up on Friday. By the way, all the other stuff, just as good. I don't want to like pinpoint and say,
no favorites.
Favorites. No, all the other stuff, just great. Let me introduce our panel to you. We'll get started. We have a lot of news. All three of our panelists came in and bowed their heads and said, you know, a lot of news. And that's absolutely right. So Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead, Anna Markowitz, joins us. Good morning, Anna. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Really nice to have you on the program, as always. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain joins us. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you all. It's I'm of Irish heritage. I think you are also, aren't
yes,
you, Joe?
Yes, I have a bit in me, yes.
Yeah. No, I think of my grandparents who came from Ireland back more than 100 years ago and settled in Troy, New York, and then met each other there and got married and raised a family. They came here with hope, like immigrants come from all over the world with hope and prosperity. And, you know, it wasn't easy to do it, but immigrants do it. And we used to honor that. Some people still do.
It used to be part of our origin story.
Yeah, right.
And hopefully it always will be a part of our origin story. But that's right. And we certainly thank all those who made those sacrifices and came over and were part of our communities and did not have an easy time, as we well know, and not just the Irish, of course. We also welcome, we are thrilled to have Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. Catherine Tan is with us. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
How are you?
Good. Spring
I mentioned,
break.
Yeah, spring break. Oh, that's
oh.
right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good on you. Your research is on health, wellness, and medical knowledge. We're going to talk to you a little bit about vaccines coming up, so we'll get into
my favorite.
We'll tap that knowledge base in just a few moments. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear from you as always. Let's get started on the news and what is happening. And a couple things that we'll talk about today. I mentioned the overhaul of the vaccine and the courts coming out on that, the vaccine policy blocked by a court. We're going to talk about the TSA troubles that are happening in airports because it is spring break and the lines are around the airports and for people trying to go where they want to go because the TSA agents are not being paid and they're getting a little antsy and many are not showing up for work and because there is a shutdown. So we'll talk about that as well. The president spoke about taking Cuba yesterday, and in case you thought there was going to be some peace in the world at some place. That happened. We are going to continue our conversation about what we talked about yesterday in regards to, because it was more the story was forwarded yesterday regarding treason and the Trump administration saying that the media, that was the word that was used by the president, that the media is being treasonous in their coverage of the war because they are lying and it's fake news and everything is going great. We begin by telling you about how everything is going great.
Oh, good. You guys can stop listening. There is nothing to hear. Everything's great.
U.S. intelligence says Iran's regime is consolidating power despite withering airstrikes. Officials see a weakened but more hardline government in Tehran, backed by the powerful Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps security forces. Despite more than 2 weeks of relentless airstrikes, U.S. intelligence assessments say Iran's regime likely will remain in place for now, weakened but more hardline, with the powerful Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps security forces exerting greater control. The U.S. and Israel have significantly degraded Iran's missile capability and navy, removed the supreme leader, and wiped out scores of top military and intelligence leaders, but the war's costs are mounting. At least $12 billion so far and 13 U.S. troops killed. Iran's vice-like grip on the Strait of Hormuz has slowed shipping traffic to a trickle, creating a historic oil disruption that is obviously impacting the United States. However, it is impacting the world at large. Meanwhile, probably the top headline this morning is Israel says it has killed a top leader who was a Khamenei confidant. The death of Ali Larijani is a blow to Iran's power structure. The killing of Mr. Larijani, according to the New York Times, would remove a prominent voice of defiance who was also seen as a pragmatist with clout to negotiate with the U.S. Now, Iran has says they have killed, that they have killed Larijani. However, that has yet to be 100% confirmed. So, meanwhile, pulled into war, Gulf countries face the limits of U.S. security guarantees, barraged by Iranian attacks and questioning the value of security ties with the U.S., Gulf countries have turned to Ukraine, Australia, and Italy for help. Meanwhile, the president also, when it comes to the Strait of Hormuz, is saying, hello, friends, come help. We need you. Come bring a ship filled with gas and oil, and maybe you'll get shot at. And they're saying, no. We're good. And that is making the president quite angry, and he has spoken out about that as well. So that is detailed in a fascinating article in the New York Times called America Alone. So that gives you an idea of the stories that we are talking about. I will present it to our panel members. They can take any scrap of what I just mentioned, and we'll bring it all together in one tidy bow by the end of our time together. Catherine, would you like to begin?
Yeah, we're going to fix all this, yes, in this next hour. You know, when I'm thinking about this, I'm going to bring a little bit of levity to something that's not very funny at all. I used to live in Chile, and I have a dog, and I used to take her on, horseback, trail rides in the Andes. And when she was little, we would go with a pack of other dogs. And there were a lot of, like, doggy gangs out in the mountains, and she would inevitably pick fights with these dog gangs that are actually pretty scary. And then the dogs that we would take with us would kind of, like, be like, we never asked to engage with this dog gang. And she would, because she was a puppy, would immediately retreat because she's like, oh, crap, I started this fight. And then the other dogs would kind of have to finish it up. And so that's sort of what is going on here. This is an incredibly unpopular war that no one else asked for, right? This is entirely a Trump-initiated war, and it's completely devastating. Like, thousands of civilians have died in Iran and Lebanon. And when we think about the long-term environmental consequences, people are going to have health issues for decades to come. You know, they were reporting on how there's acid rain and there's all this gunk and people are breathing and living in these spaces. And for what is really the question people, and even experts are continuing to ask, because Trump is saying, well, we're going to decapitate this regime, but the regime is still in place. And even though they are killing off the leaders, the regime itself is pretty much intact. And if anything, it's going to galvanize and bring people together. Months earlier, there were a lot of protests against the regime. But now when you're faced with something like a war from an outside country, that's going to bring people together. So if anything, we risk actually reinforcing the powers that are already in place, and especially now with them installing Mojtaba, I don't see how this is overthrowing the regime in any way. Plus, there's no organized opposition party to take over. So I'm not surprised that no one else wants to join this party. It's kind of wild that Trump thinks China might even step in when China has a great relationship with Iran right now. Why would they want to spoil that? But for me, this is an entirely senseless war. And what's really devastating for me is what's going to happen to all of these civilians who are stuck in the middle of it.
Also, a war of choice, as you point out. Mm-hmm. The China connection is interesting because the president was going to meet with President Xi, and mm-hmm. it's been announced that is probably going to be canceled now. Is the reason because of friction between the two over what you just outlined, or is it just because of the war and they're going to wait till the dust settles a little bit, and perhaps it's a bit of both? Anna.
Yeah, I mean, I think Trump is learning real time why every other president has said no thank you to mm-hmm. joining this war with Israel. Israel has asked many a president to join. They've all said this is not a good idea. I think Trump was emboldened by his easy capture of the Venezuelan president and said, hey, you know, maybe my thing can be regime changes. Mm-hmm. And was happy that they were able to, you know, kill the president right away, but now we're seeing that it's not as easy as he thought, that this isn't just a you can kill the leader and then the whole thing crumbles. It's like America, where if you killed one leader of a Republican or Democratic Party, it's not that there's nobody else to replace them. There are many, many layers of people. And in fact, this got them to choose someone who's more hardline than they would have, because it recently has come to light that the president didn't want his son to take power after him, that they actually wanted other people who aren't related to take power because it was overthrowing a monarchy that started their whole government. And so now we're seeing someone who is more hardline than they would have ended up with without our intervention.
And I wanted to add to what you're saying. So, yeah, Trump is going around thinking, yeah, maybe my thing could be overthrowing regimes. We haven't even finished the first one, right?
Yeah. Like,
Venezuela, nothing has really effectively changed, right? And he just sort of, you know, moved on from that project before it's done. And now he's, you know, in Iran. We're looking now at Cuba. He starts these projects and they don't ever finish. And we're destabilizing these countries, but not in any way that would bring about a positive change for the people in those countries. You know, when he went after starting this war in Iran, he told the people, okay, go ahead, do what you want with it. But it doesn't work like that. And it's wild to me that he thinks in any reality does politics work in that way. And I think this stems from the way he understands the Republican Party, right? From Trump's perspective, I surmise, he believes that he is a core part of the party. If Trump is removed, there's a lot of infighting in the Republican Party right now. The whole thing could collapse, right? We have a strong, charismatic, authoritarian leader in the Republican Party. And I think the way he thinks about it is that in other countries, the structures are just as weak. Right. Whereas in Iran, in Venezuela, in Cuba, these are strong regimes. But Trump sees the leader as possessing the most amount of power. And when you remove the leader, everything falls apart. But that actually just tells you what he knows about the Republican Party and how little he understands the way these other countries function.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, no, building on what both of you are saying, I think it's kind of no surprise that traditionally our biggest allies, the countries that in NATO and other countries around the globe, are not interested and are rather offended that they're being dragged into this, or efforts to drag them into this dispute, this war that's going on in the Middle East. After a couple of years of, you know, the first Trump administration and now the first year of Trump's second administration, where he's basically urinated all over our allies. He's trashed NATO. He's wanted to build no coalitions. He just wants to have it his way. America first is the way that they describe it. And now he's turning to them after he makes a great big mess and asking them to bail out the United States and bail out themselves, because they're adversely affected by this. So he's basically made a mess and wants them to clean it up. And that's the way they're looking at it. And, you know, in the end, these have been our allies, and I think they're going to be there for us on the really deep existential issues. But right now, they're very reluctant, and I'm not surprised at all. And he shouldn't be surprised. And he needed to do what other presidents have tried to do, that build coalitions, use diplomacy, make the case that Iran was a rogue nation that we all have to rein in, and we have to do it as a group. It kind of sounds like Obama's effort to broker the nuclear deal, you know, that we were in during the Obama administration, where we were putting the screws onto Iran but offering them some relief economically, and it was working. Mm-hmm. And we threw it all out. But working with our allies against a real threat. I mean, Iran is a rogue nation, and they want to disrupt the Middle East. They want to disrupt the West. And, action was warranted, but the action that we took was not warranted. And we had ways to deal with this, and it's really tragically sad that we chose another route and got ourselves into a big mess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Trump did there was no effort in trying to sell this war.
No.
To anybody.
Even the U.S. citizens.
Even to the U.S. citizens. And even when you hear
even Congress. Oh, right. They didn't care.
They weren't there. Okay. They were not consulted on this one. But, yeah, even when you hear in hindsight or in retrospect, what the justification is, it doesn't even make sense, right? To say that Iran and
which justification are you talking about?
right. Which one? Is it the regime? Is it nuclear weapons? You know, and to argue that, yes, like Iran is a rogue country. At the same time, their nuclear capabilities are not anywhere near high levels of existential threat to us at this point. And they said something
like, according to the International Atomic Energy Commission.
And it's something like, I think they had estimated we are like 15 years away from them actually having strong capabilities. Isn't that enough time for some diplomacy to strike a deal? Isn't he supposed to be the president who's good at making deals? So I feel like 15 years is more than enough time to kind of figure something out. It's not the existential threat that Republicans who are backing Trump are claiming this to be.
And I apologize. For speaking the obvious here, but this cool little diplomatic trick of saying to other countries, "Well, you're losers. You're weak. You're stupid. You're idiots. By the way, will you help us?" and be surprised that doesn't work is interesting to me. Especially because what they said from the beginning of why he called them stupid in the first place is because they were very hesitant about an action that seemed to have little justification and great danger to the people and the equipment that they would be putting into this mix. That's a lot. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation with this brilliant panel. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. I have new admonishments about letters. I want to read those real quick. Here we go. One per show. Keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic. Do not include links or attachments, and don't use abbreviations. And pre-read your emails before you send, so they have things like points and verbs. Also, very helpful. But thank you. We love your letters, and we welcome them. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll return right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable on this St. Patrick's Day, and it's 40 minutes past 9 o'clock on this 17th day of March. You know, tonight the USA will be playing Venezuela in the World Baseball Classic, and I was just looking at this as I was getting ready to go on, and I think, well, according to Wikipedia, they're the same country, right? We're just playing ourselves. I didn't realize that. All right, let's go to... I think a couple of points that I would I'd like to bring into this in regards to what we're talking about, and a lot of what has been said already is that we simply don't have a sense of what the end goal is. Now we are caught into this problem when it comes to oil and the Strait of Hormuz. And one European official said the likeliest post-war scenario is a rump IRGC regime in Tehran that will retain some nuclear and missile capability as well as the support of regional proxies, though the regime will be degraded enough that we're in a better place than we were.
That's a really optimistic way of looking at a pretty awful situation. I mean, I agree with Anna that, you know, when you bomb out, you know, and you destroy the first level of leadership and you let younger, more angry, more fired up leadership take over, it can't. And then you bomb the hell out of the country. It's not a stable situation that's going to resolve any decade soon, you know.
No. So IRGC, of course, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. So when I use that, I apologize for using an acronym, but you'll know what I mean. And to your point, Mike, Trump has been receiving very sobering briefings on U.S. intelligence, said one of the two people familiar with the assessments, and he told of the likelihood of a more entrenched IRGC before he gave the go-ahead to jointly launch the war with Israel, this person said. That according to reporting in the Washington Post. You may remember reporting prior to the war and the first strikes that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dan Kane, said our issue is the problem we're going to have is about is with the Strait of Hormuz, and that's going to be our issue. And he was told no, because we are going to obliterate their military firepower, and that won't be an issue. Well, and to our knowledge, at no time has Dan Kane said, I told you so.
Mm. Well, you just to dovetail off that, and I don't mean to dominate this, but I mean there's been reporting in the last week about how all of the military advisors in the intelligence community in the U.S. have been warning Trump that you're not going to be able to knock out and topple the government, and he just evidently, you know, doesn't listen to advice. I mean, he really doesn't trust what he hears from the people who know the most, and that's tragic. And look at the mess.
Even President Trump yesterday expressed surprise at the breadth of Iran's retaliations. They had Qatar, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait. He said, nobody expected that. Nobody. We were shocked. They fought back.
Yeah, nobody was shocked. Only you. you know, how did he think that this was going to go? This is obviously how it would go. And even in some best case scenario where he did topple the regime, who would take their place? I mean, in Iraq, killing Saddam Hussein just gave way for ISIS. So I don't see how this could possibly be in our favor. And it's disappointing that he would do this. And it's kind of like, why? Why is he doing this? Is it to distract from Epstein? Is it during a election year to somehow seize control over elections? Like, what is the end goal? What is he trying to do?
The other thing... Mike is throwing up his hands. I mean, the other thing...
I don't know.
too, is that I just don't know... something that I have tried to read up on, because one of the options that is being talked about, I think Josh Hawley was the first person to float this on Fox News, and it's gained traction even within the administration, that we declare victory and then we just take our toys and we go home. And which I don't understand, but the real part I don't understand and why I don't understand it is because, well, what does that mean for Israel? What does that mean for the Israel army? And what are they going to do? And what does that mean for our working with them? And it just doesn't seem as though even that part of a quote unquote strategy that perhaps doesn't isn't fully thought out.
I mean, I think Netanyahu was saying that he was going to attack Iran regardless, and said, "Hey, Trump, you are the only way that we're going to be able to topple this world leader," and he took that bait. He did topple that world leader, but didn't have a plan for what came next. You can't just kill the world leader and then leave. They're not just going
to
be like, okay, we're done. Thank you for that one strike. We'll wave the white flag. It was obviously going to continue, but it's like nobody thought about it.
Attempts to topple regimes rarely work out the way, you know, the U.S. hopes it would. In this case, you know, like thinking back to the summer, you know, Ukraine asked for help and we were like, no, that's, you know, you're good. We're, you know, let's work with Russia on this one. And now suddenly, without any lead up, Trump was quick to just jump in with Netanyahu and participate in this war that he couldn't sell to his own country, to the citizens. So, what is the end goal? Like, how do we even get out of this, mm-hmm. right? At what point could it possibly end? What would it take for this war to end?
Well, and there's so many consequences. I mean, obviously, there are the economic consequences. What does it mean for the cost of oil, the cost of gas, mm-hmm. what it does to the U.S. economy, the possibility, God forbid, of boots on the ground. What does it mean for casualties? What does it mean for U.S. casualties? What does it mean for citizens who are killed? I mean, there's so many ramifications to mm-hmm. this, which there are with all wars. But these are things that seem to be worked on now, as opposed to having an idea going in of what they were going to be. I just hearken back to a couple of days into the war, and they said, well, I believe it was Pete Hegseth, and if it wasn't, I apologize. But it was someone within the Pentagon who said that the upside of having, first of all, that if we have a plan, we have a strategy, and we're not going to tell you what it is. And number one, number two. But if we didn't, that's okay, because then we can decide what the ending is. Well,
God.
That's not.
That's not how it works.
That's not a.
That's not what I look for in my novels.
It's they're going about it in such a shoddy way, and we see it immediately day one when they bomb that school. Like, how could you, with all the intelligence that you have, with all of the technology that we have, how could you have made that mistake on day one, right? And you're already, this is already a war that nobody wants, and you're going to bomb a school and kill all these kids. That's really going to make us look like the good guys coming in, right, to help the Iranian people.
Which we still, even with quote-unquote proof, we still haven't taken, I don't think, has really been addressed to a full extent.
Mm-hmm.
And the reports have come out and have said it was the U.S. But
the Pentagon is doing a certain kind of investigation that they have to do when these issues come up, and it takes months. So at one point, there's going to be a report, Joe.
I mean, I feel like a simple Google search could have avoided this, right?
Well,
like
Google
search on Google Maps would have told you.
Google
what,
Earth
what's there.
Would
have told you what
absolutely
is there.
That has been pointed out. I just want to go to some letters in a minute, but I just want to point out something. This is an article in the New York Times. What are Trump's positions on Iran? They can change by the sentence. The president is no stranger to staking out contradictory stands. Part of what his aides say is his negotiating style. But on Iran, his shifting positions are colliding with the consequences of war. We don't need anybody, he said, echoing a refrain he has sounded since the beginning of the war. But he added, other nations must take up the task of securing the Strait of Hormuz, whose near closure by the Iranians is hobbling the global oil supply. His remarks were the latest in a string of dizzying turnabouts in Mr. Trump's positions on the war, sometimes issued in nearly the same breath. He has called it just an excursion, but also a critically important means of addressing an existential threat. He has said the United States has already won, but added that it should not leave yet because it still needs to finish the job. Again, Trump, no stranger to offering conflicting messages, he has long employed ambiguity as a strategy to appease differing factions in his political base and declare victory even in situations where the details are murky. But as the president's contradictory positions have collided with the chaos of war, whose rationale and endgame he has struggled at times to delineate, the effects of his shifting positions threaten to radiate around the globe. And although Mr. Trump has often muddled the waters to outrun international crises, retreat from tariffs, or back off threats like his push to seize Greenland, he has not been able to talk himself out of the rising scrutiny over his decision to wage war against Iran. The conflict in Iran is not just one of Mr. Trump's rhetorical threats on the global stage, but has come with tangible consequences like a rising death toll and soaring gas prices, causing even some of his supporters to accuse him of betraying his campaign pledge not to start new wars. James Kimball is a historian of rhetoric and propaganda at Seton Hall University. I want to be a professor of rhetoric. He says, the lack of discipline and the lack of clarity strongly suggest that the administration was simply unprepared for the messaging aspects of this conflict. I think it's more than the messaging aspects, though, right? It's also the military aspects.
It's the whole aspect of having a plan, having an end game, going into a conflict, creating a conflict, or accelerating a conflict militarily, that you at least have to have, you know, plan A and plan B. I mean, it sounds like we have plan A through Q. I mean, it changes all the time. And it's not, you were mentioning, what we've said about Greenland, you know, and the talk about Cuba, which we may talk about, you know, taking over Cuba now, and, Venezuela, of course. And I agree. I think he's acting on hubris as he was dragged into this, that we can knock out Iran and the leadership. And now all, and just today, the story you talked about earlier, Joe, about killing this this top leader, Larry Gianni. I mean, at least he was somebody we had contact with that we could, quote unquote, negotiate with. Who's left? Who's left who has any perspective on that? I mean, we're messing up the mess we made.
Well, there was that really concerning day where the president was like, well, we had people in mind that we were going to reach out to, but now they're dead.
Hmm. Yeah, he said that. He said, and I suppose in that meeting, he said something to the effect, I suppose, and I think this was with, the German chancellor who was visiting. He said, I suppose we may get someone who's worse. That's always a possibility, you know. I mean, that is always a possibility, isn't it?
Let's go to some letters from our listeners this morning. And we'll bring us up to the top of the hour. Right now, I'm more concerned about the Strait of Taiwan, writes Liam, not Hormuz, the U.S. Navy's stockpile of Tomahawk missiles, among other munitions, is seriously depleted. I'm sure this is seen by China as a potential opportunity for aggression. That from Liam. Kate says, heard you speak about Iran being a rogue nation, which I totally agree with. Do you think the rest of the world is starting to think of the U.S. as a rogue nation?
Oh, 100%. We're going around with our imperialist attitude, and I mean, even we couldn't predict what we're going to do next.
Yeah. I mean,
and they'd add tariffs to that, too.
Yeah, and add tariffs to that.
Yeah, ask Canada about it. They're like, we're going to be your 51st state. What?
It's like, don't worry, just give it a moment and we'll move on to something else.
And whether they would call it that in front of a microphone is different, but certainly by just asking them for various supports during the conflict and their ambivalence to do so would give you the sense that, yeah, they're they're not exactly trusting this quote-unquote rogue nation.
We have a stable genius running the country right now, so you should definitely get in line.
Kate writes, continues and says, we have a president who will go in and take out another country. President, we have a president who will not consider talking with Congress before he enters a war. Just curious, not trying to be a wise guy. Thank you for your thoughtful conversation this morning. And that's sincerely from Kate. We go to Jeremy. I'd love to hear some thoughts and conversation about how to address the mass human rights violations committed by the Iranian regime absent military intervention. Well, there is that, isn't there?
Well, we're not helping. I mean, we're not. It goes back to an issue with the regime. And when we decapitated it, I mean, it was still, we didn't decapitate it. It was more like, you know, when those lizards lose a tail and then they just grow a new one. It's more so that than decapitating.
A great metaphor.
It's more so that than decapitating a snake or whatever. this is really going off the rails, but, it's an oppressive regime. They killed thousands of their own people. That's a problem. But what we are doing does not help the citizens of Iran at all. If anything, we have galvanized the existing the party that is in power and their supporters. If anything, we have really undermined the protesters and their cause. Right.
Yeah. The protesters originally celebrated for, you know, about
10 minutes.
when the leader was killed, and now they find that his son, whose father, wife, and son all got murdered in this attack, is now the leader. How is that going to help anything? If anything, it's going to make it worse. And now they're afraid of, if we do pull out and if we do leave this hardline government, what is their life going to be like moving forward? Is it going to be even worse?
He doesn't even want the job. Like he didn't want it. And you know, someone had said, well, it's customary to deny a couple of times before accepting. But you know, he didn't want it. The people around him didn't want, his father didn't want him to to be the next one, because, you know, the 1979, it was resisting a monarchy. Mm-hmm. And now we're just kind of reproducing one.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have to deal with daddy issues on top of that.
And subject everybody else to it.
All right, we're going to take a break. We have much more to discuss. We'll get to all of it on the other side of a break. We welcome your letters, as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we are going to take a break and hear news from my favorite Irishman, Ray Grant. No, German, right? We'll be. If you were German and Irish, it would make you a meticulous drunk. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC. Yeah, it's great music. It's St. Patrick's Day. I hope you have a lovely St. Patrick's Day. Mike, I know you've been to Ireland.
Oh, a couple of times now.
Yes, yeah. And have either of you been to Ireland?
Mm,
yeah.
Nope.
I have to say, I like Mike. I've been there a few times, and it's just a gorgeous country. It is a simply gorgeous place, and I have one little quadrant to go. From like Galway up into Sligo,
oh, yeah.
And in that area over to Derry, and that's sort of the one area that I haven't fully explored yet. But I just remember we have a dear friend who is a tour driver and brings us around, but he's been a friend. He saved my life, literally saved my life, and is just an amazing guy. And so we were driving down this road. There was in the morning they go to pick up the kegs from the night before. And there are a lot of them. I mean, it's unbelievable. But it's like putting out the garbage, in the sense of there's just like 50 kegs out on the street, and then some government agency comes in and picks up all the kegs on the outside. So there's a bunch of drunk guys from America jump on the back of the truck. The kegs shift, they fall in the guys. The guys roll off the back of the truck. Then they go into the road. The
Were you one of these guys, Joe?
No,
is
no,
that
no,
what
no,
you're
no.
trying to tell us?
No.
That's how the guy saved your life, was that he got you out of the road.
And then the kegs are really falling on the guys, and our driver Peter just stops and looks up and says, "Blanking amateurs."
And he knows how to dodge a good keg rolling at you.
He does. So I fell down a flight of stairs,
oh,
and I had a ruptured both quadriceps. I had a bilateral quadricep rupture, and I couldn't get up. By the way, completely sober, and I know you're not going to believe that, but I was. So we didn't know what to do, because we were in this pub, and we didn't know where to go, what to do, so we called our friend Peter. Peter came in, had a wheelchair, got us out of there, and just literally picked me up and brought me out. And I don't think Peter will be mad if I say this, because I've said it to his face, but pretty sure he's IRA. and here's why I think that, Mike. Because the next morning,
you used an acronym there. Perhaps you should identify
Irish
IRA,
Republic,
right?
Army. There are scars on that man. Anyway, so we go the next morning. I have to go to the airport. And Peter puts me in the wheelchair and just brings the wheelchair to the plane. And I was like, well, what about security? What about checking in? He's like, yeah, don't worry about that.
That's amazing.
I was like, man, that's pretty good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Good dude.
That's a good Ireland story.
Very good. Yeah, it was fun.
Are you going back, Joe?
Yes. Well, to finish up, yeah.
Yeah, that one section in Galway up to Sligo and up to up to Derry now.
Yeah, and back since I love it. It's just the most beautiful place. I would love to live there. But let's see. I made a joke at the beginning, and Mike said it was I should probably attribute to give its attribution. It was a very funny, I thought at the time, a very funny joke that was done by Bob Newhart on the Carson show, because Newhart was half half Irish and half German. We got a letter from Joel who said folk artist Eric Franzen, who is half Danish and half Scottish, said that a friend once described him as having the charm of the Germanic people and the discipline of the Celts.
I guess you can make fun of your own people.
That's right. All right, let's go on. We have much more to discuss. So what do we all make of this brouhaha over the FCC? This got the head of the FCC, Brendan Carr, made a statement over the weekend, had an ex post saying that he felt that news organizations who were that reported, quote, fake news regarding the war should have their licenses taken away during license renewal time. Those licenses should be not renewed. Now, then the president came in and said what those news organizations are doing is treason, which I believe also, and several news outlets have made this connection, that the treason is a crime that could mean the death penalty. And is that what the president is saying? I don't know. Is that he's not saying that? Let's put it that way.
Well, he says a lot of outrageous things and uses social media to say it. Probably the more worrisome aspect of all this is the head of the FCC, Brendan Carr, threatening to pull licenses and essentially muzzle some established and very credible news organizations, and using the power of the government to kind of clamp down on it. And that's kind of scary. It reminds me of, you know, some of the discussions that happened during the Vietnam War and the way that the traditional and established news media covered it. You know, the Pentagon would announce every week, you know, we killed 4,500 Viet Cong. And then news media began to look into that. And then there was the leak of Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers, which showed that we were losing the war and it wasn't quite going as it was being portrayed. Is that not patriotic? Is that against what we're supposed to do as journalists? I don't think so. I think the journalists are supposed to report the facts as best they can determine them and use attribution. And when they don't know, they say what they don't know. And, you know, I'd argue that a nation that was founded on a principle like the First Amendment, you know, should respect credible attributed journalism as a way to understand what's going on so people can make more informed decisions. And you know, for Carr, and then also Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, was saying he couldn't wait until Skydance takes over Paramount and you know, when the Ellisons are in charge, because the Ellisons are favorites of Trump, and, you know, then maybe they'll stop all this, you know, CBS coverage. They've already muzzled 60 Minutes. If they take over HBO, they'll be in charge of CNN and they'll muzzle that. That's the fear that a lot have. And, you know, clamping down on legitimate, important journalism is a really scary thing. I mean, they did it when they pulled funding from public broadcasting. It cost WAMC $500,000 in annual funding, and it crippled some smaller stations all around the country, and who all they were doing is reporting the news. So this is a very scary, scary thing. And flexing that muscle, as Brandon Carr does, I think it's a lot more serious than Trump just mouthing off and talking about treason, because he says crazy stuff like that all the time, and we're kind of used to it.
Yeah, this is regular flavor fascism. And, you know, this administration, they believe that independent media is there to serve them. And really, like, why shouldn't they believe that, right? Because this is what you get when you have, you know, guys like Bezos buying up the Washington Post and then choosing not to support a candidate during the election, because, you know, it would, if by not choosing one, they were effectively supporting Trump.
The other one.
Yeah, exactly. And then afterwards, he donated to Trump's inaugural fund.
Sure.
Yeah. So you know, a precedent has been set. Like, why shouldn't they believe that they can buy independent media? But this is a really dangerous, you know, trajectory that we're on. As you point out, Trump says stuff all the time, but to have Carr impose real action, right, to have real material outcomes is dangerous. You know, we started seeing that when, you know, they went after Colbert, they went after Kimmel, and now when these stations are being bought up, we're going to see some real changes in how the news is presented.
I don't know how many people saw the chart that the president posted over the weekend. This was from Truth Social. And it was a chart that says President Trump is reshaping the media. And this is what it says. Gone, PBS defunded, NPR defunded, Terry Moran out at ABC, Joy Reid out at MSNBC, Lester Holt out at NBC, massive layoffs of the Washington Post, Colbert leaving CBS, no more biased fact-checking at Meta, Chuck Todd out of NBC, big decline in MSM ratings, Jim Acosta out at CNN, John Dickerson out at CBS. As far as reforms go, record-setting interviews on 60 Minutes, Truth Social is booming, first POTUS to join an NFL broadcast at the NFL, the FCC broadcast accountability, most accessible POTUS ever, $15 million settlement for ABC, saved TikTok, new ownership for CNN, to be determined, I believe, news bias ombudsman for CBS, Disney ends key DEI practices, free speech on X, equal time on broadcast television. And then finally, under winning, he shows a picture of Time magazine with him on the cover saying it's Trump's world, and a quote from The Guardian saying Trump is waging war against the media and winning. And finally, from The Hollywood Reporter, Trump's media pit bull is off the leash, referring to Brendan Carr. So it is not just the unspoken, it is the quite deliberate and spoken.
Is that attributed, that list that he posted on Truth Social? Like, does it say who put that together?
It is one of those. I'm sure it came from another source, but he posted it as his own on his account.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it basically endorses it when you post it and repost it like that. But it's obviously some sycophant who wants to play right into Trump's hands. And I mean, playing up his ego is very effective if you want to get something done in your favor.
I mean, I think he's going to keep attacking the media over and over and over again in hopes that at some point he does get to censor the media. I mean, he tried it with Kimmel, and Carr threatened to revoke licenses there, too. And these are things that he shouldn't be doing as the FCC chair, but is doing anyway and seems pretty emboldened to continue that.
We're going to see like news media becoming, or journalism becoming, incredibly fragmented, right? So, you know, if we can't trust these, you know, legacy publications and stations, then, you know, unfortunately, we have like social media and other ways of following individual journalists we trust. But also there's the issue of if they don't have any funding, how are they going to be able to do the investigative journalism that we rely on? Right? And so I imagine in the future, as this progresses, many Americans are just going to turn to international news for reliable information.
Well, I mean, one of the problems, and it's not new, is that there's been a realignment of news media because of technology, because of the internet, and that democratization, so-called, of letting everybody publish their own opinion in their own situation, and it does cause a lot of confusion. But the Trump administration, from his first term, has been doing everything it can to undermine the news media in a sense that people don't know. You know, people get maybe when they hear something now, they wonder if it's true or not. People need to learn how to navigate the news media, how they need skills in something called news literacy, where they can look at a story that might look, they might be skeptical about it. They can look for other sources. They can look for sources they trust, look at the attribution, see if the attribution is by name. And you know, there's just a whole bunch of ways that people can try to break through this mess that has, this mud that's been sort of slinged upon all media, and in the process has hurt the credibility of very legitimate traditional media and even new very legitimate ones. There's a lot of new ones that are really great, but there's so many others out there that it's very hard for someone who's a casual looker to know, am I looking at one that's trustworthy or is this not trustworthy? And then in the end, they don't trust anything.
It is interesting. We had a panelist yesterday who said, "Well, look, this is not something that's going to go. It's not a credible threat because of the First Amendment, and it's not going to be able to be moved forward. And we'll see you in court." I understand that. But I do think, as evidenced by that chart. And looking at the Kimmel issue, the Colbert issue, obviously a lot can be done without that. And in muzzling the media, as far as actual license renewal, yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly how that can work out. And as I made this point yesterday, and I'll make it again, which is that NBC, CBS, NPR, they don't have licenses. They have affiliates who have licenses. Mm. So if you're not going to renew the license, it's not just one and say, I'm not going to renew the license of NBC or I'm not going to renew the license of ABC. You have to do it to the affiliates.
Right. And that threat, you know, is real. The owners of stations around the country are terrified by it, and they turn around and start badgering ABC about, you got to rein that guy in who's on it late night because he's causing a lot of problems, and we can't exist if we don't have a license. So the pressure goes right back up to ABC or NBC or CBS or whoever, and that's where the real muscle is. It's controlling all these local licenses that the FCC has to sign off on that they are threatening not to, and that scares the businessmen, the business people who are running these operations, not the journalists.
Well, we'll see what happens in that regard. Over the time that is coming. Let's move on and move to other issues. We can probably get one more in before we have a break at the bottom of the hour. And let's see, we go to this story in regards to Cuba. The president is saying now, talking about taking Cuba, and saying that it would be an honor to take Cuba. The president's words came amid a nationwide blackout and, as a top Cuban official said, his country would move to open the economy to foreign investors. President Trump raised the possibility of the U.S., quote, taking Cuba on Monday, telling reporters at the White House, "I do believe I will be having the honor of taking Cuba." Taking Cuba, I mean, whether I free it, take it, I think I can do anything I want with it, he said. They're a very weakened nation right now.
Yeah, whose fault is that?
The president's words came on the same day as Cuba experienced a nationwide blackout amid diminishing fuel supplies. On Monday evening, Cuban officials had also planned to announce that the country's communist government would open itself to foreign investment, including from the United States. Cuba is open to having a fluid commercial relationship with the U.S. companies, along with Cubans residing in the U.S. and their descendants, the deputy prime minister said in a clip of an interview posted by the network on Monday morning. It is unclear how widely Cuba intends to open its economy or how the moves compare with those made a decade ago under President Barack Obama. But the scheduled announcement coincides with a severe humanitarian and energy crisis, with some experts saying the island could run out of fuel within weeks because of a de facto blockade by the Trump administration. What do you all think?
I mean, okay, so them opening up their economy is a good thing. However, how it's being forced is terrible. Like, we cut them off from their fuel supply for how many months has it been? Like 3 months or something like that? And then to come in and say, for Trump to say, oh, you know, I will happily take over and help them out, is just so pompous and gross. Like, we basically destroyed their economy. There's, what was it? They have a national blackout. The food is running low. Fuel is running low. Like, we've choked off the whole country. And then to now come in and say, oh, let us help you out after we have dragged you through the struggle, is really something else. I mean, this is some sloppy imperialism that Trump is playing here. And also, what's the long-term plan? Again, you know, this is something we discussed earlier in the show. How is this regime change going to work when he hasn't, you know, finished the others that he started, you know, like, you know, finish your war before you start something new, like, or finish your regime change before you start another one. It's this is not, you know, once again, this does not bode well for Cuba, with Trump coming in, thinking he can install whoever as the next leader. So
how about Marco Rubio?
right.
And this one is closer to home, you know. Yeah. This is not Iran and Ukraine on the other side of the Atlantic. You know, should we be trying to do regime changes and topple countries that are so close to Florida? I would go no. But
well, we've done it a lot. And maybe it's just a habit we've had. You know, previous presidents have tried to reestablish normal, quasi-normal relations with Cuba, especially as the Castros were kind of aging out and the country was reaching out. And you know, if you want to go to Cuba, go to Montreal and fly there. I mean, you know, other countries have normalized relationships with Cuba. We don't. And, you know, we go over the history, but it certainly it hasn't been that way for a long time, since the 60s or in the late 50s when Castro took over down there in the revolution. And the, you know, it just makes sense to normalize with Cuba. I mean, there's so many Cuban-Americans. There's so many people who have a stake in Cuba. It would mean Cuban cigars would be available again in the United States. But truthfully, it would mean great baseball players would be coming and being on more teams. And, you know, it's a culture that's directly connected to the United States, directly connected to Florida, and why we can't make it work with them is tragic, and it was beginning to take hold until Trump came into office in 2017.
I mean, Obama did a lot.
I'm going to hold you there, just because we're We need to take a break at the bottom of the hour, and I have missed it twice, and I want to our wonderful new board op Bailey. I want to impress him, so we'll do that, and we'll be back right after this break and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion for the 17th day of March, otherwise known as St. Patrick's Day. And we wish you a very happy St. Patrick's Day for those who celebrate. It is 35 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we welcome you and your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We have a couple of stories. We were talking about Cuba. Any letters that people would like to share on that, we can certainly include those. And we're going to move on to other topics. But we welcome your letters on the subjects we're about to talk about, as well as Cuba. And we'll get to those before the end of the program. Okay. So let's go to an issue that I spoke about at the very beginning of the program. A judge has halted Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s vaccine overhaul, citing flawed process. The judge said the government has undermined its history of recognizing the importance of involving independent experts in setting the national public health agenda. A federal judge on Monday blocked the Trump administration from implementing sweeping changes to the nation's childhood immunization schedule, siding with major medical organizations that argue Health Secretary RFK Jr. unlawfully altered vaccine policy and improperly reconstituted a federal vaccine advisory panel. This reporting from The Washington Post. Under Kennedy, the federal government has cut the number of shots routinely recommended to children, including for flu, hepatitis A, rotavirus, and I'm not going to be able to say this. It's meningococcal.
Meningococcal?
Yes, meningococcal. I did say it, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Thank you for being a cheerleader. That disease. And Kennedy also dismissed all 17 members of the vaccine advisory panel to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last year, installing new members, several of whom have criticized vaccines, especially COVID-19 mRNA shots. Catherine Tan, we begin with you.
Well, I mean, this the Department of Health and Human Services is going in the same way as many other departments and agencies under the Trump administration. But with this move, it's important to push back against misinformation, and this is a step in the right direction. Of course, it will inevitably be appealed, but as what it represents right now is incredibly important to remind the public that RFK is not spouting real science. He is a known anti-vaxxer. His health recommendations are incredibly questionable and lack scientific evidence. It's also important to remember that anti-vaccine sentiments have been around for as long as vaccines have been compulsory. So in the U.S., since like 1879, that was when the Anti-Vaccination Society of America was founded, and it was in objection to the smallpox vaccine. And at that time, a lot of the rhetoric is similar to what we're hearing now. It's sort of, this is my body. I get to do what I want. Screw public health. It's been sort of this similar messaging for a long time. We cannot trust what's coming out of these government agencies anymore, unfortunately. They have been like you know, as Joe had mentioned, the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices has been completely replaced with RFK's people throughout the agency, our new Surgeon General. These are all people who are, you know, quacks, essentially. They are peddling health information that lacks scientific evidence, that are not substantiated. And, you know, it is important right now for people to turn to organizations that they trust. And if we cannot trust what's coming from the government, it is important that people turn to medical organizations to see what is being put out there. You know, science in, you know, reliable medical information is out there. It's just not where you would normally turn to in the past. Now we have to go to like medical associations, for instance. And really, it, you know, this is an issue of what we're seeing right now is vaccines being a victim of their own success, right? I think a lot of the public is, those who are willing to trust RFK and his anti-vaccination sentiments are willing to go that way because vaccines have been so successful, right? Like we, at least, I mean, I have never seen measles before. I've never seen whooping cough before. And it's because vaccines work. I've only seen one case of polio, right? Like it's because vaccines work, and people who have not had that firsthand experience, who do not know people who have died, like measles used to wipe out like entire towns. And we don't have to deal with that anymore because, you know, science did its thing, and we vaccines was revolutionary. So it's just really sad to have our leaders in positions of power peddling misinformation. And it's really scary where this can go, right? Like public health requires everyone to participate, right? It's not your individual choice, right? Well, it is, you know, you have to consent, but it's public health works because people opt in, because it's compulsory. So it's really scary to have a government leader tell everyone, no, no, it's your choice. You can do whatever you want, because that's not how this works. You know, this works with everyone participating together collectively for the collective good. So I, you know, this whole situation is incredibly bleak. And when vaccinations rates drop, disease spread, right? You need everyone to participate. And there's also an element of this, I know I'm kind of going on for a while, but there are also elements of this that are incredibly classist, right? The idea that you can just opt out and protect yourself is a classist notion that, oh, okay, if something were to happen to me, well, I have access to the best medical services. I can afford that. So I'm fine. Forget the rest of you, right? And so the ideology that is being pushed by RFK and, you know, the minions that he has put into these positions of power to decide whether or not we get vaccines, like they are working under the assumption that everyone has the ability, the financial ability to protect themselves, to access healthcare in an equal way, when that is just not how it works. Right. We need people to participate in vaccines because it protects our most vulnerable populations.
I have a question and 2 points, mm-hmm. Or 2 statements. One is the question aspect. Have we come down now of who decides when a student goes to school as to what vaccines are necessary for them to begin classes?
Have we, like, change that? No. Like, so all the state policies, to my knowledge, have remained the same.
And those are state policies.
Those are state by state. Yeah. There are 5 states that require medical exemption and will not accept philosophical or religious exemption. But for the most part, all those policies are still in place. Like, you still have to vaccinate your child if you want to send your kid public school. Yeah. I mean, you have this like homeschool movements and people have other ways of getting government funds not having to put their kids in school.
I got a postcard in the mail a couple of weeks ago from my vet, and it was time to bring Tully in for his vaccinations. And so I brought him into the vet, and he's gained a couple pounds, but who hasn't? And so they get him up on the scale and do the whole thing, and they're getting ready to give him the injections. And I, being who I am, I said to the vet, who I love, I said, let me ask you a question. Are people questioning vaccines for their animals? And she said, oh, my God, no. She said, I've had a couple of people say I wouldn't have my daughter vaccinated, but I'm certainly going to get my beagle vaccinated. That, to me, is fascinating.
That's very strange.
I mean, that's really interesting. I just find that to be, like, that is extremely anecdotal. However, I bet there's data.
Yeah, well, so when I was researching the anti-vax movements years ago, there were families that did not vaccinate their pets or vaccinated them selectively in the way they vaccinated their children selectively. It comes down to how people perceive risk, right? So I imagine, I don't know for sure, but I imagine a lot of these families are thinking, well, my dog or my cat, they're vulnerable to rabies because there's wildlife around, especially around here, right? There's possums and raccoons. So, I want to make sure that my dog doesn't get rabies. And in that risk calculation, they're like, well, you know, suppose my dog gets dog autism, which is something I've heard people say. It's not real. It's not a thing. But when I was doing research in the anti-vax world, there were people who were worried of such a thing that does not exist. But so in their risk,
I need to go take a nap.
in their risk calculation, they're like, okay, rabies is a much bigger deal because that can be brought to my family. Meanwhile, you know, in our country, we treat disabled people horribly, even though most of us will be disabled at some point in our lives. But we treat disabled people horribly. And that is something everyone knows, which is why disability is so scary. And the idea that vaccines could cause disability is horrifying to parents, right? Which is not true, right? Vaccines does not cause autism. It does not cause disability. It does not cause any developmental disorder. But the suggestion that it could scares people away because they think, well, if my child gets measles, well, I can fix that, or I can potentially take them to the hospital and they can recover from that. Well, in worst cases, no, they can die. They can have permanent damage to their immune system, to their brain. But people don't think of it that way, right? They're thinking, well, anything but a permanent disability, anything but a developmental disability. So this misinformation really appeals to parents' fear of disability. And it's horrible because it works. Even when people believe in the efficacy of vaccines, the fact that these lies, you know, are out there, it's in the back of their minds, right?
We're going to pause. We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll finish up the remainder of the show. We welcome you. Last chance for letters. Last call for letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We will finish up on the other side of this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Mike Spain, Catherine Tan, and Anna Markowitz making up our group this morning. There was a story that broke while we've been on the air in the last half hour or so. Joe Kent, one of the United States' top counterterrorism officials, announced he is resigning, citing his opposition to the Iran war. And what he said was Israel's influence over the Trump administration's policies. Mr. Kent, the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, wrote in a social media post in the last hour, "I cannot in good conscience support the ongoing war in Iran. Iran poses no imminent threat to our nation, and it is clear that we started this war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby." Mr. Kent's post included a resignation letter addressed to President Trump, in which he argued that Israeli officials drew the United States into the conflict with Iran. In the letter, Mr. Kent wrote about what he saw as a misinformation campaign by high-ranking Israeli officials and the news media, which he said had undermined Mr. Trump's America First platform and sowed pro-war sentiments to encourage a war with Iran. Mr. Kent is a veteran of the Iraq War and said that the arguments in support of attacking Iran and promises of a swift victory echoed the debate over going to war against Iraq in 2003. He also referred to his late wife, Shannon, a military cryptologist who was killed in Syria. So that's
big
through.
Because he's a big, good friend and an ally of Tucker Carlson, you know, a far right. I mean, I think that Trump is getting opposition not only from mainstream America and the left wing of American politics, but also from the far right. And this guy is certainly been embraced by the far right. And, you know, it just shows you how it can close in on the president politically. It's not good for the president when this kind of thing happens.
And, I mean, counterterrorism. There is a large risk right now for counterterrorist attacks in the U.S. They're saying it's the highest that it's been since 9/11. Mm-hmm. And so I could see where if I were the head of that, I'd be like, you're not going to make me look bad when, you know, this attack happens on, you know, whatever town, city it does.
Well, they weren't going to listen to him anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So that is the latest. I'm sure we'll talk about this more tomorrow, but that is breaking as we are on the air this morning. The other story that has been brewing for the last several days, and we haven't addressed it fully, and I thought we should, which is security lines at more and more terminals in airports across this country are just, I mean, they're so long, and the TSA workers are going unpaid. Travelers at a growing number of U.S. airports are encountering shuttered security checkpoints and waiting hours and lines that extend well outside the terminals as the partial government shutdown enters its fifth week. I think we're all used to the announcements that we hear that when we go to the airport, we should allow at least for 90 minutes to 2 hours. And I heard a recording that was played at an airport. I believe it was Logan, I think, but I could be wrong, that they expect 4 to 5 hours for people to come and to give themselves 4 to 5 hours.
Domestic?
To deal with. Yeah. So about 50,000 transportation security officials, officers have been working without pay as Congress remains at an impasse over funding for the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees the TSA because of a disagreement on immigration enforcement. TSA officers missed their first full paycheck on Friday after receiving only a partial paycheck at the end of February. As bills and rent come due, a growing number of TSA employees have picked up second jobs, sometimes calling out sick to do so. More than 300 officers have quit since the shutdown started, according to the department, and more than 10% did not return to work as of Sunday. Our officers are coming to work, but they're going to There's going to be a breaking point sooner or later, said Christine Vettel, a TSA officer at Chicago O'Hare International Airport and Executive Vice President of American Federation of Government Employees, Local 777, a union representing TSA officers in Illinois and Wisconsin. A handful of small airports bore the brunt of the disruptions in the early stages of the shutdown, but in recent days, the long lines have spread to busier hubs. Security wait times at the George Bush Intercontinental Airport in Houston reached 2 hours in one of its terminals on Monday. At Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International, the world's busiest airport, wait times were over 2 hours. On Sunday evening, three of Atlanta's four domestic security checkpoints were closed, while the remaining checkpoint experienced wait times of hours, according to the airport's real-time wait tracker.
I mean, it's a real shame that the TSA agents are really being used as a political pawn right now.
Sure are, yeah.
Yeah, they want, the Republicans want to show, oh, well, you should fund ICE because look at the airports and these poor TSA workers. And yeah, it's true. These poor TSA workers, they are some of the lowest paid government employees in the nation. The average salary of a federal employee is over $100,000, and it's around $60,000 for TSA workers. They don't have the cushion, the savings to just show up and not be paid. They have rent. They have expenses to pay. And so they have to get these other jobs. They have to quit and take other full-time employment. And so, you know, it's a real shame that they're being kind of held hostage.
And I would hope that, like, the American people are not looking at this inconvenience and think, wow, we should probably fund ICE, right? Yeah. I really hope that's not what people are getting.
There's money there. I mean, we do fund other, like, ICE agents, you know, ICE and Homeland Security got a $70 billion funding under the budget bill last year. And they got plenty of money sitting around. They could pay them. And we pay other essential workers. It's just like politicians, when a budget is frozen, they'll like close the national parks to make the public angry, but they'll keep other things going without any hesitation. I mean, why? I mean, and that's what some of these bills that are being proposed would do. It would include them in essential worker categories where they'll get paid and during these crises. I mean, you're right. You know, Anna, when you say that they're being used as pawns, it's the third time, I think, that they're being denied pay or something like that. It's just terrible.
We have to go. We're out of time. I just want to quickly correct. While we were having our conversation, I said Logan. It's actually LaGuardia Airport that said between 3 and 4 hours.
So, LaGuardia.
LaGuardia. Wow. So that's a big one. So there's that. My thanks to our wonderful group this morning, Mike Spain, Catherine Tan, and Adam Markowitz. I thank you all for being so wonderful. Great to have you here. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Enjoy your day. Thank you. We will continue the program after this short break.